Yeah, some people look upon musicians and I like we as magicians, you know, but the real magic is when we come together and work together. Yeah, two are better than one. It's the only way I can have some fun. And I really know that difference between magic and music, to tell you the truth. I won't say magic, I won't say music, but it's all in how you use it. Music is a tool, I and I is a vessel. Yeah, I and I cite myself as a one where music can use me. Most high can use I, play music to I. Yeah, inspire ones and ones, creation.
Was a little bit of Keon Harold's The Mugician, spelled M-U-G-I-C-I-A-N. Keon Harold is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast. This is episode 28, and we're in our second year of doing this now. So if you've been with us for a long time, thank you. And if this is the first time you're hearing the show, I hope you like it, and I hope you come back again or dig into the archives, all of which are available for free on iTunes and other podcast aggregators. The show is part of the OSIRIS Podcast Network, which has over 24 shows on a wide variety of topics, including music, parenting, writing, craft brewing, and many more. Visit OSIRISPOD.com to learn more about all the different shows and see if any of them appeal to you. And if you'd like to become a supporter of Burning Ambulance, you can visit patreon.com/burningambulance. We appreciate that a lot. Keon Harold is a trumpet player who's been making quite a name for himself in the jazz world over the past few years. The Mugician is his second album under his own name, but he's also worked with Gregory Porter, Marcus Strickland, David Sanborn, Dr. Lonnie Smith, and a bunch of hip-hop and R&B artists, including Beyoncé, Jay-Z, Maxwell, Mary J. Blige, and Big Crit. He was also picked by Robert Glasper and Don Cheadle to be the trumpet player on the soundtrack to the movie Miles Ahead in 2016. His music is a hybrid sound that combines jazz, funk, R&B, hip-hop, rock, and some really nice string orchestrations, too. The Mugician is a major artistic statement, one that fits in with the work that people like Glasper and Christian Scott and Terrace Martin and other people are doing, but it's definitely its own thing. At the same time, it extends a long history of jazz musicians engaging with the popular sounds of their time, whether it's Herbie Hancock embracing funk in the 70s and hip-hop in the 80s, or, if we're focusing on trumpeters, players like Donald Byrd and Eddie Henderson, who made albums that were sometimes straight-up disco records on the surface, but still included some serious blowing. Anyway, this was a really interesting conversation, and I hope it's one you'll enjoy listening to. As with the previous episode, there's a lot more music than we typically had in year one, and I think I'm going to continue doing that going forward because it really helps frame and shape the discussion, and it provides a broader picture for you, the listener. So throughout the next hour, you're going to hear not only Keon Harold's own records, but records he's played on by Marcus Strickland and Christian Sands and the Miles Ahead soundtrack. In fact, the next piece you're going to hear is Junior's Jam from Miles Ahead. So listen to that, and afterwards you'll hear my conversation with Keon Harold. Up in Ferguson, Missouri. I have never been to Missouri, so tell me what it's like there.
Okay, Ferguson, it's you know, it's a very, it's home for me. I don't live there now, but, you know, just growing up, it was beautiful. Many great memories, great people, a great sense of community, you know, which was fantastic, but, you know, outside of that, you know, there's a lot, you know, there's a two-sided coin there that has to do with, you know, bias and racial discrimination and systemic issues, that, you know, were, basically brought to the forefront, you know, at the end of the Mike Brown situation, beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement, you know, a lot of stuff was exposed as to what it was.
Is it like a small town? Is it, or is it like suburban?
Ferguson is suburban, very suburban. And, you know, if, you know, despite what most people think, it's not like a totally black place. There's, you know, there's probably more white people than black people. It's just that the way it was exposed on television was that it looked like this, you know, pretty, you know, downtrodden kind of city, but it's actually not that at all. You know, the suburb of North County in St. Louis.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you're one of 16 children. Are you one of the youngest or one of the oldest? Somewhere
I'm like
in the
middle.
Yeah.
I'm in the middle.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And how many of your siblings are musicians?
We all had to do music growing up. We didn't really have a choice. My father and my mom were in the ministry. Dad was a pastor. Mom was, also a minister. So we did, a lot of the Levite work in the church, keeping the church going musically. And, that plus the idea that, my grandfather had a drum and bugle corps, which my dad was a teacher and taught me how to play. All my siblings, older than me, all learned how to play. And one of the things was we typically, my grandfather's grandsons all had to learn how to play the horn, learn how to play the soprano bugle, same as the trumpet, just in a different key.
Uh-huh.
We all had to learn how to play. I looked up to my brother, my eldest brother, who was like a prodigy at the age of 6. He was playing like triple high Cs. So I wanted to be like him. So eventually when I had the opportunity to play, I played, and, one of the wages that my grandfather set was, well, once we get more people, because he helped, thousands and thousands of people in Ferguson, all over St. Louis, all over St. Louis City and all over, thousands of people kept him out of trouble, out of crime with this drum and bugle corps, because we were doing a situation that involved lots of discipline and focus and actually learning and craft. So we all had to learn how to play the horn. And when there would be enough time, well, enough people who, would come in and take care of the horns, he would give us a chance to switch to drums. For me, that never happened because I started playing, and by the time more people came playing the horns, it was like I was already, stuck doing it. I didn't want to switch over to drums. My brother Emmanuel, who plays drums with Gregory Porter, actually did switch to drums. So now he's an amazing drummer out on the scene right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So him, myself, my brother Steve is a musician, songwriter in the past as well. My brother Robert is a keyboardist, singer, songwriter. My brother Al is a science teacher, bass player. My brother Frank is a horn player and an engineer. I would say, out of all of my brothers, it's 9 boys, we all do music. And all of my sisters sing.
Yeah.
And on my album, at least 11 of them are on the project in some way.
Yeah, yeah, I noticed that. I was going to ask you about that later on. It's interesting, the drum corps thing that you're talking about, because I was in Norway in May, and the day that I was there, they had a big event for drum corps from all over Norway kind of gathered in this one city, and they were having like competitions and marching through the center of the city, and I mean, it was like thousands and thousands of drummers, and it was really loud. And I was asking people, I was like, what is what is with all the drummers, because I mean, it's an extremely white country in Northern Europe. I was a little worried that it was going to go political on me all of a sudden, but it turns out that it's exactly what you were saying. Like, it's something to keep kids out of trouble. They, they wear the uniforms with sashes and stuff like that. And, I mean, like older kids teaching the younger kids, the rhythmic patterns and stuff. It was, I was watching, some of the like 15-year-olds teaching like 6-year-olds how to play a certain role or something. It was very interesting. So so
that's
you
what I did from the age of 6 to 17 every year, seriously.
Yeah So you came to New York and went to the New School, and you met up with Robert Glasper and Marcus Strickland there, it seems like. So what was your student experience like?
Robert Glasper and I, we met early. We met in high school, at a place called Vail Jazz Camp. Him, myself, and a fantastic musician, Terrence Martin, and Brandon Owens, we all met at the same day. I was a sophomore. Robert was a senior on his way to New York, so we were playing together at this all-star jazz camp. But getting to the new school, it was an amazing crop of people there, and connections there. Robert went there, the Strickland brothers, Marcus and EJ, Brandon Owens, Mike Moreno, Bilal Oliver had just left. There were so many, you know, amazing artists at the time. We would just be sitting in the hallway, you know, jamming music, you know, playing people's new music, playing the music that was being made at the time. We had great records being made. Common's record, like Water for Chocolate, D'Angelo, Voodoo, Erykah Badu, Mama Gun, what else? Mos Def's album. And what we would do, we would literally go to Electric Lady Studio and just, you know, maybe like sit in on different sessions and, you know, see what was going on. Because we had, obviously, we didn't know the history that was being made when it comes to, you know, Soul Aquarians, and it comes to the, the new wave of R&B at that time. We really didn't know what was going on. It was a amazing movement at Electric Lady Studio at mm-hmm. that time. Mm-hmm. But in school, you know, just learning and being with such an amazing open group of people was very, very cool and inspiring.
Yeah, yeah. It's a good school. I mean, I went there for audio engineering in early 2000s, so, gotcha. You know. But you were part of Charles Tolliver's big band for a couple of years, and he played on your first album. So did you study with him?
I did. Charles is that's my guy, a mentor, a visionary, and somebody I looked up to. He gave me an opportunity to play on his Blue Note record with Love, on a song called Hit the Spot. I mean, I was, you know, a young kid, and he was letting me know that, listen, Key, you gotta, you know, take no prisoners. Anytime you get the opportunity, you gotta kill it. You gotta play hard. You gotta go hard. So, you know, just checking out his career, checking out, you know, playing in this band, him giving me the opportunity to basically be his stunt double. You know, when he wasn't playing much, I would play all the solos. It was an incredible opportunity for me. Mm-hmm. To work with Charles, and you know, it was such an honor to have him on my album. On my first record.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's a huge guy for just sort of self-reliance. I mean, the fact that he and Stanley Cole started Strata East, you know, just said,
exactly.
Nobody else
changed
is going to put out this music. We're going to put out our records, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, what would you say the big lesson that you took away from working with him was? Just to kind of push that way?
Yeah, take no prisoners and always... you know, never let up. And whatever vision I have, whatever situation that I'm playing in, to push it to the limit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is a question I always like to ask people. Whose influence would you say, because you're still a comparatively young player, so whose influence would you say has taken the longest to work through or kind of synthesize enough that you can call it part of your own voice rather than imitation?
At this point in my career, playing wise right now, I don't think I'm really imitating anybody. I'm pretty much focused on my concept and the way I play. I feel like I've developed a sound enough to where it's identifiable. People know that it's me. I can tell that it's myself. I'm influenced by clearly so many. Miles, Clifford Brown, Freddie Hubbard, off the bat, as people who I have learned from and borrowed from and appreciate their sound and what they've done and what they've added to who I am as an artist. As far as having to shake something, I've been playing a long time. I think I'm past the idea of, you know, learning how to speak.
Yeah.
I'm at the point where I'm actually communicating and I'm saying my own things.
We'll be right back.
So your debut album, Introducing Keon Harold, came out on Crisscross in 2009. So how did that work? Did you, like, get an email from Jerry Teakens one day, or did somebody put in a word for you? You know, what put that deal together?
I have to remember back. I'm pretty sure he had heard me somewhere and wanted to do a record, and it was, you know, between either doing something for him or doing something on Fresh Sounds at the time. Mm-hmm. Both of those labels were kind of, you know, battling, and it was a good breeding ground for, you know, people putting out their first records. So, you know, at that time. So I'm sure he heard me and, you know, wanted to do something.
Yeah, yeah. And what was the session like? Like, I mean, it was a single day probably, right? And so, I mean, were you nervous going in? Were you fully prepared in your mind?
Man,
you know?
it was a single day recording, and I had, you know, wrote some songs before, and I was basically, when I went to the studio, it was like a day after being on the road with Jay-Z. So it was pretty interesting in that way that I hadn't been playing a lot of jazz. I mean, other than, you know, sitting in and doing a few things at the time, I was more so touring, you know, all the time with pop artists. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to record these songs.
Yeah, yeah. That's actually my next question, because you've done a lot of work with R&B and hip-hop artists like Maxwell and Mary J. Blige and Big Crit and Beyonce and Jay-Z. So what's a session like that like? You know, do you just kind of walk in, see the chart, and play and go? I mean, is it...
When I go into a session, since I'm a producer, I'm not just a trumpet player, I'm a producer, arranger, you know, songwriter, and an artist. So when I go into a session, they call me to be myself. So typically they call me to write the arrangements, or they call me to produce the song, or, you know, or be the artist. So it's never really, you know, at this point, people putting charts down in front of me, and I plan, you know, I do that for other people. Like I hire the people to come and do charts at this juncture. You know, when it's with Maxwell, I'm arranging the horns and, you know, playing and being featured as a soloist. When I work with, you know, anybody at this moment, they call me to be myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause that was my question. Like, I was curious whether it was like a real creative exchange or whether you were like a piece of the puzzle that they were building, but it sounds like you're building the puzzle as much as them.
Yeah, I mean, definitely a piece of the puzzle, because they know that they want my input, they want my sound, they want my essence. So, you know, example also with Max Miller, rest in peace, you know, when he called me, he knew exactly, you know, he wanted me to do what I do, and we did the song Stay. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, Maxwell just announced a third record in his trilogy. Are you on that one? Do you know anything about it?
I heard about it, but we recorded lots of songs in the past, so I don't know if anything else is going to be on there. So I'm not sure yet.
Yeah. And you said you were out on the road with Jay-Z back in 2009 before doing your record. So what's that situation like? Is that, you know, just a horn section situation where you have prescribed parts ready to go that go with like the light show and the you know, everything else? Or
we did a song called The Rock Boys, an American Gangster album, and, you know, myself, Kenneth Whalum, Sondra Sermon, we arranged the, you know, the horns on that song, and it turned out to be, you know, a pretty big song for Jay-Z, and we went on tour and we were in the video. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that, you know, we did that, and there's a couple other songs on there that obviously I arranged for us to play. You know, there's never at the kind of gigs that I do, typically I'm the one who creates the parts that we play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chosen, I guess, by Glasper to play on the Miles Ahead soundtrack for the new tracks that were on there. So what kind of preparation did you do for that? Like, what kind of conversation did you have with yourself about how much you wanted to sort of do Miles and how much you wanted to play as yourself? Because, you know, what we've been discussing about your style, I hear you as being a very different player. So, you know, What were your thoughts about that?
I mean, Miles Davis is a part of my DNA as a musician, as an artist, as a trumpet player. So I've been listening to him my entire life. So it wasn't something that I needed to practice for. Like, I know what Miles sounds like. I've transcribed many solos. I know, you know, lots of, you know, a big part of, you know, what his sound is, what his work is. I knew his nuances. I knew, you know, the angular approaches at different times in his life, you know, post-bop, you know, bop, you know, hard bop, all the way to fusion, all the way up to when he's working with rappers. I've listened to all of the, you know, the transitions, so I know them. So when I got the call from Robert and, you know, and Don Cheadle for the most part, it was basically, you know, come in, you know, we believe you could do this, and let's see what happens. So we recorded it, and they basically sent many of the demos to very, very reputable people who were basically, you know, convinced that it wasn't, you know, it wasn't someone else, that it was the 60s quintet when we played, as far as what the demos were for the movie. You know, but as far as me playing at Miles, you know, I enjoyed it. It was a blast, you know, doing that whole process. Happy that the project received a Grammy soundtrack. You know, I also, in the movie, had the opportunity to play like myself, which is, there's another character in the movie called Junior. So that's, you know, my style of playing. Mm-hmm. So Junior was, I guess, kind of like Miles' muse to get back to really playing.
There's the one track on there, What's Wrong With That, where Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter are also on the track. Was it all at one time? Were you in the studio with those guys?
Yeah, we were in the studio and we did that. Very, very interesting. We, you know, it was amazing opportunity to record with Herbie and Wayne, and get a chance to stand next to Wayne and actually play and him be like, you know, try this, or go this way. Think about music in this way. It's a, you know, a pretty great experience to actually be that. Definitely, standing on the shoulder of giants, you know, knowing that Wayne was next to Freddie Hubbard, next to Miles. It's like, to me, I'm just like, damn, wow. Mm-hmm. I have that opportunity. And yeah, we recorded that together.
As we discussed earlier, you were in school with Marcus Strickland, and you're on two of his albums, I think. I know you're on Open Real Deck from 2007, and then the one that he just did, Nihil Novi, in 2016. Mm-hmm. So how do you think your two voices work together, and what kind of territory does he open up as a composer for you to, like, wander around in?
It's, you know, we're friends, and, you know, we respect each other's musical vision, and we very well complement each other. Like, we go back to the new school, playing in different ensembles, and, you know, when the opportunity permitted itself, you know, for him being on my records, because he's on both my records, and I'm on two of his, it's like, you know, it's a pleasure. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, musical kinship, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there is such a sort of a partnership in a lot of ways between trumpet and saxophone. I mean, you know, you got Ornette and Don Cherry, you've got Miles and Wayne, you've got Wayne and Lee Morgan, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, or Lee Morgan and Hank Mobley, you know, like just these, you know, teams. And mm-hmm. so do you feel like you have that same kind of creative relationship there?
Absolutely.
There's
a serious vibe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different kinds of music on that record. It's a very mixed bag kind of an album. But the track that really sticks out for me, and the one that I'm actually going to play a little bit of in this piece, is Sissoko's Voyage. What can you say about recording that track?
It was, you know, a very cool song based on a sample that Marcus had found somewhere. It's a beautiful song. Him and Michelle and Diego Cello put together. It's just, you know, very interesting. It goes different places. It is a voyage. And, you know, it's a beautiful piece.
What was she like to work with as a producer?
Michelle was great. Really cool, very supportive. She really believed in who I am as an artist. It was great to really meet her in that situation. So, you know, I look forward to working with her in the future.
Marcus also both play on a couple of tracks on Christian Sand's new album, Facing Dragons. The one piece that you're on, Frankenstein, has a really interesting structure because each of you takes a short solo, then it kind of goes back into the main body of the piece, and then you each get a second short solo. So talk to me about that, how that piece, you know, and the arrangement and everything came together.
I mean, that's all Christian right there. We brought in the chart and we, you know, talked it down as it would be better, you know, to split courses versus all, you know, take several courses as the interaction. You know, each soloist has his own voice, so it's more, it seems like more of a, you know, a call and response kind of thing through the voices of the instruments. Very cool record, very great record, Christian Sands.
Yeah, no, it is. It's really good. Now, let me talk to you about your album, The Mugician. First of all, why did it take you 9 years to put out a second album under your own name?
You know, it took a while to basically conjure the ideas that I wanted to convey. When I did my first album, I was basically playing tunes that I had already written, and I just wanted to record something. For the second album, me as a producer, trumpet player, as an artist, as a writer, as a person who, you know, was married, then divorced. So it was a long process that I had to live life, and I had to figure out how to put all the tools that I have in one place. Basically, you know, edit a lot of things to make one project. So it took me a long time to be able to express my views on hip hop in the essence of what jazz is. It took me a long time to put together, okay, if I feel this is classical, how do I put that over, you know, a groove? How do I make a hip hop vocal fit well over some improvisation? So it took me a long time to figure out how to fuse everything together and make it all one project. And, you know, that's just the way it works sometimes. You got to live a little before you can actually put stuff out. Mm-hmm. So it took me a while to grow as an artist. Before, I was just a player. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You released two tracks, MB Lament and When Will It Stop, before the album came out as tributes to Michael Brown. So I'm curious, did your family know his family? Was there like a personal connection to that incident other than it happening in your hometown?
No, we didn't know his family. My dad lives still very, very close, like a stone's throw away from each, from where it all happened. Mm-hmm. I grew up on that street, so my connection was that, you know, knowing what it was like to grow up in Ferguson, knowing that me being a black man, you know, 6 foot tall, you know, sometimes I can be looked at as threatening to people until they get a chance to talk to me and see what I'm really about. And that's unfortunate because, you know, a lot of things happen unfortunate to people just because of the way they look. The bias, the, you know, the prejudice, you know, just the ideals of what happens by simply walking down the street and just being yourself is, you know, is unfortunate. The situation with Mike Brown was the ultimate, you know, the epitome of, you know, what goes wrong, you know, when the power dynamic is such, you know, when it comes to law enforcement, unfortunately. And that's what it was. So I had to write that song in homage to his parents, to his family, to all of the people who, you know, who've been killed by police for no valid reason. You know, police are supposed to keep people safe, not kill people. So, you know, and the idea, you know, that these people had no weapons or anything, and, you know, were, you know, many feet away from somebody and being shot in the back, it just doesn't make sense to me. So anyway, that being said, you know, I have a son, and I'd be you know mortified if anything would ever happen to him or one of my brother's kids. So that's what I did. It was just basically giving a vibe and a feeling without words to what had happened in Ferguson.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that a lot of your siblings and your mom all appear on the record. So what's your family's take on your music, generally speaking? Because I know a lot of jazz musicians whose families don't really get what they do.
My family is always around music, and they've always seen, you know, they've seen my process. So they definitely support what I do.
Do they listen to your music for pleasure, though, or do they just sort of, we're your family and we support you kind of thing?
They both.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I know guys who've told me, you know, that, like Matt Shipp, the piano player, told me once that when he told his dad that he was going to be a jazz musician, he says, you know, you can go ahead and do that, but, you know, Mozart starved to death. So, you know.
Yeah, I don't really have a choice in that matter. You know, coming from where I came from, and, you know, the I guess the way I came, I really didn't have any. I had other options, but I didn't really base my thing on anything other than music. I always knew I wanted to do that. That was a dream of mine. I didn't second guess that at all.
And there was never like a push toward a more immediately commercial form of music or anything like that?
No. It's always been what I wanted to do when it comes to my family.
The music on the record is really, really complex and layered. I mean, there's the string arrangements, there's a lot of different guests, there's all there's all types of compositions and everything. So tell me about the recording process, because obviously this is not your typical jazz record with five dudes in a room banging it out in a day. You know, it's completely the opposite of your first album. So talk to me about making it.
It was a, you know, it was a journey, it was a process, as I said, of 9 years of, you know, basically doing research and figuring out how to pour it onto one canvas. Lots of elements, lots of thoughts, lots of people, lots of time to think, you know. It was, you know, first of all, you know, conceptualizing each song, then conceptualizing the song in a way that it was arranged in a way that was special and unique and different. So each element of that is, you know, a part of the fabric of what made the album. Each person is very specific. There are no session musicians on my album. Each person was special from the standpoint of I want that person to be on my album. They all have a purpose and, you know, are connected to me above music. You know, from the features, Gary Clark Jr., Big Crit, Bilal, Phantom Munch, you know, Robert Glasper, Jermaine Holmes, George and Marge were all special people that, you know, enhanced me musically. And, you know, I only heard their voices on what the concept of the songs would be.
Did you, in a way, have technology on your side in the sense that you could sort of fly parts in rather than having to, like, gather everybody into one studio or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Technology was definitely a plus. But for the most part, we recorded together. There are things that I did production wise, things that my brother did production wise that was mobile, but for the most part we were in the room together.
So where did you record?
At Shelter Island Studio in Manhattan. Most of it, and I did some stuff California, at Danny Masterson's studio. I did some recording at Germano Studios. I did some recording at Blastoff Studio. And I did some recording at Mission Sounds.
And what was the timetable? Like, how long was the process from roughly beginning to end? Like, not from the first idea, but from when you actually started laying stuff down?
Recording? It was about a month.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And how did you, were you shopping it to labels, or were you already signed, or what was, you know, how did you get on?
I recorded the record. I had a bunch of options as to what I wanted to sign, who I wanted to sign with. It turned out that, my manager, we decided to do a partnership between Sony Legacy and Mass Appeal. Mass Appeal being a very current, you know, urban kind of existence, and Sony and Legacy in their reach, you know, also being very influential in why I wanted to go with them, you know, just very cool.
So you think that for the music you're making, a major label has the kind of reach and promotional muscle that you need?
Sometimes it's more about me finding the correct audience for myself. The record labels, they do what they do, you know, to get behind the artists, but, you know, I have to, you know, I'm finding people, I'm finding the fans and finding the people who love what I do. So it's more of that, continuing that, you know. I like the record label. I like what they, you know, what they provide, you know, in a partner.
It feels to me like you and a lot of other players more or less your age, like Glasper, Strickland, Christian Scott, Chris Dave, whose album you're also on, you know, there's like a whole sort of generation of guys and women who are creating a kind of hybrid music that's part jazz, part hip-hop, part R&B, part rock, without prioritizing any one thing over the others. So when there are so many things going on like that, tell me what your creative process is like and how a piece comes together, sort of.
Yeah, going back to what I was saying about why it took so long to come back, it's like the equivalent of a child, you know, a two-year-old, you know, from the age of, I guess, maybe one to about four. I mean, you hear words, you hear sentences, and it's cool, but then all of a sudden the child is, all of a sudden speaks in a way that is, you know, you get the point, and it's very clear, and you don't have to worry about the Google and Gaga and all that stuff of what language is. It's the same way to me in the building blocks of creating the music. You know, it takes a while. You know, you start off and you learn, okay, you learn all the rules, you learn all the standards, you learn what people did to get out of the box. But then after that, then it's time for you to make your own statement. And my statement is made up of lots of different things. It's not just, you know, bebop. It's not just straight ahead. It's like, I love Radiohead. I love a lot of different things. You know what I mean? So all of that stuff goes into each element, each song, each instrumentation, the mix process, the kind of drums I use, the kind of sound, the kind of reverb sonically. Like, each thing matters to me as an artist. So it's not just, okay, let's just go in and record this song. No. It, you know, if I hear a beat, I try, you know, 10 beats before, you know, the idea of what the concept of the bass line is, or the concept of what the drum beat is. You know, it's not, for me, the process is not just simply just playing like that. I do that sometimes, but that's way after the fact of me experimenting on the, you know, the basis and framework that I want to have in music. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. The thing I'm curious about is, because you were talking earlier about when you were in school and being aware of, you know, Common and the Soulquarians and Erykah Badu and all that kind of stuff, and being, you know, working with hip-hop artists throughout the sort of early 2000s era. And I'm wondering whether you concern yourself with being generation gapped in that respect, sort of like when bebop became hard bop, became like free jazz. You know, you go from that kind of hip-hop to like the trap and SoundCloud rap and stuff like that that's out there now. Do you concern yourself with being generation gapped from that side of the music?
Not at all. Because you can't really worry about that stuff, because people are going to judge you anyway. So, you know, I just focus on doing what my heart says musically. I have those elements. I know what trap is. I was a producer for G-Unit, you know, and 50 Cent for years. So I know the elements of hip hop. I know the sounds. I know the producers. I know, you know, many of those things. But to me, it's not really about that. It's about, how do I package all of my facilities, all of my talents, all of my, you know, ideas about music into one solid idea. So that's what I focus on. And if it ends up with a trap beat, then that's what it is. My song, Her Beauty Through My Eyes, started as that. If it's, you know, more, you know, classically based, you know, with string arrangements such as MB Lament or voicemail on my album, then that's what it is. You know, I don't really go around thinking, okay, this is going to be straight ahead jazz, this song. No, not at all. I do the music and, you know, later, you know, it'll be defined as to what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really worry about being categorized as what it is. Long as people are touched, long as people's vibrations are raised when I deliver the music and the there's an energy transfer from me to someone else, that's all I care about.
Yeah, yeah. I think what's interesting is, you know, even though critics talk about how, you know, this kind of music that you're making and some of your peers are making is like a new thing, I don't know how new it really is, because to me, I hear you coming out of the same lineage as like Donald Byrd or Eddie Henderson, you know, both of whom made jazz records, but then they made records that were very much in tune with the sound, with all the sounds of their time. You know, there was funk, there was disco, there was all this stuff, but it all still expressed an individual personality.
Yeah, because, you know, the idea of what people miss sometimes is that jazz is like a language. So the building blocks of jazz, the 2-5-1 patterns, the harmonic approach, all that stuff is like the language that you speak. You know, you go all over the world and people speak English. So typically you can still communicate. So I look at music like that. You know, I look at music, you know, jazz is my entrance point to the way I hear music, the way I play music. You know, the genres are, you know, marketing ideas. The chords are still the same. So I use what I have, you know, what I've learned from jazz, and I apply that to that. You know, and I don't, you know, judge what the other music is. I just judge it for, do I love it or do I not?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what's your live situation like? Like, what kind of band do you tour with to be able to recreate this stuff on stage?
Typically 5 or 6 people. You know, I use, you know, drum pads, SPD pads to trigger some voices. Typically me, I sing a lot, or I'll have, you know, people come in and join me to sing certain things. Typically the band is bass, drums, keys, and guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And myself.
Mm-hmm. And, what's your future path look like? Do you know when you're going to start working on your next record? Are you working on a next record already?
I'm currently working on it now. I hope to drop it, you know, sometime, you know, the end of first quarter next year.
Oh, okay. And what's that looking like, you know, musically right now?
I don't really want to speak too deeply on it, but it's more of what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Musically, it will definitely be drawing lots of rhythmic basses, you know, I would just want you to hear it before I speak on it. But it will be a very cool vibe.
Yeah.
Okay, that was my interview with Keon Harold, and that concludes this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast, which is part of the Osiris Podcast Network. Visit osirispod.com to check out their other shows, and visit relix.com for music news, because Relix is a partner of Osiris. And again, if you want to support this show and help keep it going, please donate at patreon.com/burningambulance. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one.
Osiris.